Welcome to a new episode of Stockholm Free World Forum podcast with me, Anna Renius-Guthrie, director of the think tank. And today we have the pleasure of welcoming our American guest, Anne Stephenson-Yang. Anne, you're a seasoned financial analyst, China expert with decades of experience residing in China and founder of several companies in China within publishing, software, online media. Also, you're the author to the newly released book, Wild Ride, a short history of the opening and closing of the Chinese economy. Tell me, what brings you to Sweden?
I love Sweden. It's a fantastic place. I'd take any excuse to come to Stockholm. So I found an excuse, so I came.
What made a young American journalist, as you were at the time, first interested in going to China in the 80s?
Well, you know, in the 1980s and before, I was very much an adherent of Mao Zedong. I thought that he was a fantastic leader. He was the one who figured out how socialism applies to the peasantry. He was the one who solved all the problems. Of course, after I arrived in China, it took me about 10 minutes to figure out how dumb that was. Because it really had everything to do with the American experience and applying China to America, not to the experience of Chinese people. So I was working in New York. I went downtown and I picked up a lot of magazines at China Books and Periodicals. I wrote to them and said, would you like to hire me? And one of them said they would, so I went.
Okay. And after these 10 minutes then, what did you do in China?
Well, for the first few years, I worked at the Foreign Languages Press, sort of correcting their English and sometimes traveling around China and learning a bit about it. I met my husband there and married him, so we stayed on a little bit longer. And then at the end of 1988, I was really sick of it. So I said to him, really got to go back to the U.S. for a while.
So you went back, but then you went back to China again.
That's right. So I got a job at an investment association. I felt that I was really a failure, that I was leaving journalism. But, you know, the investment association paid a lot more. So I felt that, you know, oh, this is terrible. I'm going into business. But, you know, it was fascinating. It was much better, actually, than journalism.
In what way?
Because people would come in, you know, that in that era, American CEOs were all coming to China to visit with high-level leaders, and they would have sort of a 40-minute gap in their schedule, so their office would set up a meeting with me. And they would come into my office, and they'd tell me all these things. Things that, you know, they were open in a way that they never would have been if I'd been a journalist. I didn't know a thing about business. I didn't know. I remember meeting, I think, the Asia director of Ford Motor Company, maybe the CEO of the whole company, I forget. I didn't know what Ford Motor Company was. Probably everybody in the world does. I didn't. So, you know, I was like taking notes like mad and learning about all these companies. So it was great.
And then you eventually also founded your own businesses?
That's right. So China in the 1990s was kind of like Silicon Valley. So all I had was a sort of crackpot sort of business idea, and a friend of mine offered to finance it. So I started a publishing company and ran that for a few years and then sold it to a big groaning U.S. company, which then financed a software company. Eventually started an online media company. So, you know, yeah, I sort of bumped through different businesses.
And what could you publish in those days that you could you still publish it today, the things you published then?
I believe the newspaper is still going. Our flagship publication was an English language weekly that was distributed for free and supported by advertising. And it was a kind of like, it started out as a sort of, you know, gritty tell-it-all newspaper for the expat community. So our first cover story was on pollution. Our next cover story was on the murder of a Russian trader on the Bar Street in Beijing. Things that the Chinese press would never tell you about.
But, and it's still up and running, this publication, today?
I think so. The arrangement by which is probably more detail than you need, but the arrangement by which you publish then, you could never then or now directly own and operate a newspaper. You had to sort of attach yourself to an official Chinese media organization. So in the early days, we counted as the so-called weekend edition. of a Chinese newspaper, and their motivation initially was they wanted to have news bureaus around the country because news bureaus had to be staffed, and if you had a news bureau in a big city, then you got a residence permit for the staff. They could sell these residence permits for a million renminbi each. So they wanted to have us and have all these bureaus.
And how was it to work as a foreign entrepreneur in China?
It depends on the business. So in the media, it was very, very fraught. I spent all my time sort of running from, you know, putting out brush fires and running from this threat and that. Software was much easier, and there was a lot of talent to hire. The problems were more on the U.S. side than on the Chinese side. Online media, half and half. So it all depended.
What do you mean with the troubles more on the U.S. side?
Because it was the time of the market crash, the tech market crash, and so funding was much more difficult than it had been. So that was the problem.
You moved back to the U.S. permanently just before the pandemic. So now you've also had some time to reflect quite thoroughly, I guess, on your years and life spent in China. What is the most essential parts of what you learned from this long experience?
That's an interesting question. I think that, you know, when I first went to China in the 1980s and then again in the 1990s, everything was changing and it was kind of exciting. There was a lot of political turmoil. There was a lot of resurgence of the arts. There was a lot of blossoming of the markets in Beijing, and everything was changing. You know, organizations were exploding in number. And you felt like you were part of something that was changing the lives of Chinese people. In 1995, for example, they implemented a new labor law that allowed people to leave their places of business for the first time. Before that, they hadn't been allowed to leave unless they got permission. So then you had this upsurge of 300 million people moving around the country for work, and it created an environment that was very kinetic and interesting. I think what I learned over time was that it wasn't really a permanent change, that China was indeed a Leninist society that was planning to stay a Leninist society, and that after that the opening was designed to capture capital. And after capturing capital, it would close up again. And I think that's happened. And so it's a little bit disappointing.
So you mean that this has been a strategy from the start, from Chinese perspective?
I think so, yes. The Communist Party, which is in charge, of course, of China, has never really been interested in giving up its position of power. It showed that in 1989. It showed it at the time of the Olympics and now as well. And giving up power would be the thing that really enabled Chinese society to reform, change, and move forward, and that simply isn't going to happen.
Being an analyst, I guess you look at figures, draw conclusions, which then are used to make decisions. You personally decided to leave China altogether a few years ago, having spent the majority of the 90s and millennium years there. Is leaving China altogether what you advise your clients to do as well?
Basically, yes. I think that there are a lot of big manufacturers that need to be in China, that have big facilities, that probably are doing follow-on investing, but clearly it's a place where you need to spread out your risk and make sure that you don't have too much dependence on China, and also don't have too many foreign nationals that need to go there. So generally speaking, yes.
The living issue at large, which can be both organic and subtle, I guess has been for quite some time now a focus in the discussion in Europe as well. And Europe has decided on that de-risking is the way forward on how to handle China at large. And the idea of decoupling is almost treated as, of course, for many valid reasons, as a real taboo, probably almost not possible to discuss properly, even in some circles in academia and policy professionals. And we know also that the costs associated with decoupling have grown. Perhaps you know these figures better than I do. But what would happen if there were to be an event which forced the US or Europe to make a decoupling and needed to pull the brakes properly? Would the cost be even higher in the future then?
I think that complete decoupling is impractical and extremely unlikely. Should there be an event, you're speaking of an invasion of Taiwan, for example, then of course the people would have to withdraw, and yes, it would be costly. Would it be less costly to do it now? I don't know. It depends on how big your company is. If you're a small company, you may not have the choice to move manufacturing to Vietnam or Mexico, wherever it may be. If you're a large company, you need to look at the value chain and spread it out. I forgot where I was going with that.
You are answering the question. But I was wondering also, to a larger extent, for the West or the US or Europe at large, how big would the costs be if decoupling should manifest, so to speak, in the future? Would it be larger in the future than it would be now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the unfortunate developments of China offshoring and sort of coupling with China have to do more with Western governments than with China. I feel that the long arm of offshoring failed to be captured by Western governments, and foreign companies earned a lot of money offshore by exploiting low labor costs and low land costs and low capital costs, and that money never was absorbed into the tax system and plowed into infrastructure. So a lot of the disentangling is something that's necessary and overdue, and is not so much about the risk in China as about the failure of foreign governments to deal with overseas corporations. But the short answer is yes, companies need to spread their risk, and the costs, should there be an event, would be much greater.
A common perception is that Europe molds its relationship to China to a large extent on the US. Would you agree with this?
Yeah, one feels that the U.S. has turned more negative on China, that the U.S. cares a lot more about what China is rather than what China does, and Europe cares more about what China does and the benefits that China may convey to each country.
And do you see any big differences between how the U.S. and Europe or the EU navigate towards China at the moment?
Yeah, clearly the U.S. is leading in its sort of general suspicion of China. The U.S. is the one that imposed a lot of chip sanctions on China, which I think actually have been quite effective, and Europe has reluctantly gone along with at least some of them. The U.S. has been very suspicious of Chinese media, whereas Europe has not been. Europe, of course, has a better regulatory regime for social media than the U.S. does. But Europe has not considered banning, I think, TikTok, as the U.S. has. There are a lot of issues like that. The U.S. banning Huawei gear throughout its government telecom system is another example.
Mm. Yeah, speaking about TikTok, in Europe we've had this debate on security issues concerning TikTok, a global platform for communication whose parent company is ByteDance, and the EU Parliament banned the app on professional tools, and some governments, such as the Swedish, have put some recommendations towards professionals not using them in the government, for instance, and even some authorities are recommended not to use them in their professional daily life. However, it's a central platform in Sweden for many young people and children, where they interact and are entertained and receive news and information about the world from. How would you say, as a business analyst, is a company like TikTok to be understood essentially as a Chinese company, or is it, as they themselves like to say, a global company just like any other global company?
Of course it's a Chinese company. This is not to say that global companies are so wonderful and their social media is so wonderful, but Chinese companies have particular issues with social media. So I would say that with TikTok there are two issues. The first issue is you know, you have it's a tremendously influential platform. So if you, the Chinese government, have the ability to make Europeans feel a little bit more suspicious of their governments, a little bit more favorable toward Russia and China, if you have the opportunity to make Americans sort of more suspicious of the government, of course you do that. The other problem is that TikTok has been shown to absorb personal data in a way that would not be acceptable, even in the United States, much less in Northern Europe.
So in your sense, you're saying that this is a company that, in fact, is able to be controlled or under the influence of the Chinese state and therefore poses a direct threat to our democracy?
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
And this debate is more ongoing perhaps in the US than it is in the EU. Would you say something there about the differences?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that people get very hung up on the question of ownership, and equity structure is really not the driving factor in China. The driving factor is government control, and government, of course, is going to control media. It controls, you know, it controls all companies, but all large companies, but it certainly controls media.
And you've analyzed many large Chinese companies. Could you help me figure out how one should understand companies in general with a Chinese heritage or a starting point, at least, with who has locations around the world?
Well, the Chinese system does not create any incentive for honest reporting if companies are listed in offshore. The Chinese regulators feel that that's not really their purview, that those are foreign investors, so they don't really care. I think that in general what you find is that large public companies, state-owned enterprises, tend to have a lot of small companies hanging off their structures, sort of embezzlement vehicles, so that managers can make some money off the contracts. Small companies tend to exaggerate their revenue, exaggerate their profit, and exaggerate their cash. So one has to be very wary of these companies.
And what would your recommendations be for businesses interested in still investing in China?
Well, there's plenty to invest in, but best not to invest the way they did 20 years ago, which is to invest in hopes of selling to the Chinese consumer. That, I think, is not a particularly valuable proposition. What you should invest in is businesses for export, businesses that complement your overseas businesses. So if you want to build an ethylene cracker, an aluminum plant, something like that, China provides a scope, a scale of land, labor, resources, and money that most countries can't provide.
And do you have an opinion about what Europe has to offer China, which we could profit more from than we have up until now?
Yeah, that's a good question. Europe's sort of most reliable profit has been export to China of machinery, of cars, of things like that. Europe, of course, has a lot of technology that China wants, but it's really, really tricky to capture proper revenue stream for technology. So there are some big brand names that sell well in China, and I think what you're seeing now is a lot of the smaller companies, as the funding kind of drizzles away, a lot of the smaller companies are dying, and people with channels and brand name and marketing power, people like Adidas and Skechers and these sorts of brands tend to do well.
And when it comes to climate change, we often hear in Europe and from other places that it's important to get China on the same boat, so to speak, in order to be able to solve climate change and tackle the issues related to it. What do you think about this? Do we need China to solve climate change, tackle climate change?
Well, I think that overall, the way to tackle climate change is to stop being so obsessive about counting carbon credits and focus more generally on pollution. I think the chance of getting China on board is pretty low. It's not a high priority for China, not compared with development. So you saw when they joined the Global Climate Pact, they suddenly discovered that last year's emissions were 10% lower than they had been, because that allows them to show a drop this year, right? So I think that that's pretty typical behavior from China.
tell us a bit more what you mean with this 30 years cycles and the China's developments.
Well, if you look at these 30 year cycles, 1889, there was a sort of reform effort against the Qing dynasty. 1919, there was a big protest by youth against the current government. 1949, the communists took over. 1979, the reform began. And then 2009, we had the global financial crisis and the reaction to it, which I think really, really changed the way the Chinese government works. I think that these cycles depend largely on generational change. So leaders last for, let's say, roughly 30 years, and then there's a sort of massive change.
And the next one would then be looking forward to...
That's right, 2039. Right.
What would happen then?
Well, you know, the I have no idea what's going to happen in China. I think that the choices of the Communist Party are narrowing. I think a lot of people look to, you know, there's a lot of dissatisfaction within China and a lot of understanding that the Chinese government and social system need deep reform that the Communist Party is not going to make. And so a lot of people think, oh, well, maybe the Communist Party will just be deposed. And according to this schema, it will take another 15 years.
Mm. You don't sound so convinced, though, when you say this.
I just have no idea what's going to happen. I think that I don't see any signs that there will be, social upheaval in China, but one never knows. These things are very faintly visible.
Will you be going back to China any day soon?
I wish I could, but I feel like I can't because, not so much because of the top level political stuff, but because in China, the legal system allows any small company to bring a complaint against you. You might not know about it, and then the government won't let you leave until the complaint is resolved. And I feel that that's the probability of that is kind of like, 40%, and that's too high a percentage to risk 2 years of my life on.
And with those final words, we wrap up today's talk with our guest, Anne Stevenson Yang. Thank you very much for joining us here in Stockholm today. And thank you to all our listeners of Stockholm Free World Forum's podcast.
Thank you.